From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine the life of writer, philosopher, and feminist Simone de Beauvoir. Deidre Baer has written the definitive biography of Beauvoir, and she joins us today to share her thoughts on one of this century's most influential voices. Also today, we meet choreographer and dancer Laura Dean. Her dances are often built on the simple, joyous movements of childhood. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of works by saxophonist Tio Macero. And television critic David Bianculli takes a second look at Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Syria, Frank Reed has spoken about his 43-month ordeal as a hostage. He appeared on state television shortly after arriving in Damascus from Beirut, where he was freed earlier by his pro-Iranian kidnappers. Reed's freedom comes just 8 days after the release of another American, Robert Polehill. Mike Theodulu reports.
In a very emotional appearance, a gravelly-voiced Frank Reed said he was happy to be free and hoped all the hostages would soon be released. He looked well in a grey suit and wearing a neatly trimmed white beard, but as he spoke of the horror of his ordeal, he started to cry. He'd been well fed and was kept warm, but it was lonely, he said, and very boring. He had no news of the outside world and was kept blindfolded for 24 hours a day. He never knew where he was being held, never saw his captors, and never knew who they were. There were times when he didn't even know what month it was. He said he was seized as he was going to have lunch with his family, but he had no idea why. Probably the bottom line, he said, was because I was an American. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
On the same day that President Bush thanked Syria and Iran for their role in the release of hostage Frank Reed, the State Department formally named them as state supporters of terrorism. A yearly State Department report on international terrorism presented to Congress designated 6 countries, Cuba, Iran, Libya, North Korea, South Yemen, and Syria. Countries included on the list may be subject to certain trade restrictions. The Lithuanian Prime Minister is in Canada to try to drum up support among Western countries for Lithuanian independence. The Prime Minister indicated the Lithuanian government is prepared to drop its insistence on being recognized as a sovereign nation in order to negotiate with Moscow. Richard Reynolds reports.
Prime Minister Kazimiera Prunskiene was speaking at a press conference in Ottawa when she said the Lithuanian government would be willing to suspend its declaration of independence. She said that the Republic's government would adopt the compromise if it meant that the central government in Moscow would enter into negotiations with Lithuania. Moscow has insisted it would not negotiate with the Lithuanians unless it suspended the laws proclaiming itself a sovereign nation. Lithuania's decision to compromise may have been aided by the lack of support the Prime Minister is receiving on her trip to the West. Canadian Foreign Minister Joe Clark refused to meet with Prunskiene in his capacity as Foreign Minister. Instead, he met her as an ordinary Member of Parliament, underlining the fact that Canada, like most Western nations, still refuses to recognize Lithuanian sovereignty. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds.
Prices were mixed today on Wall Street, recovering in late trading to post a slight rise. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 12 points to close at 2,656.76. Declines and advances were about even in light trading of 122 million shares. This is NPR News. A former official of the Reagan administration's Department of Housing and Urban Development testified today that HUD was a domestic political machine. Du Bois Gilliam was a former deputy assistant secretary at HUD. He's serving an 18-month sentence for bribery and abuse of HUD programs. Gilliam told a House subcommittee that former Secretary Samuel Pierce ordered federal housing grants to people who were well-connected in the Reagan administration. Gilliam's testimony was the first the panel has heard from a former top HUD insider about Pierce's 8 years as secretary. The Supreme Court today unanimously ruled that state governments and private citizens have the right to sue to break up corporate mergers. NPR's John Idstey reports.
In the case before the court, the California Attorney General had challenged the takeover of the state's largest supermarket chain, Lucky's, by the owner of the state's fourth largest supermarket chain, Alpha Beta. The Attorney General said the merger could cost consumers $440 million a year in higher grocery bills. But the owners of Alpha Beta argued that the state attorney general's power was too limited to undo the merger. Only the federal government, they argued, had the broad power to challenge a merger that had already been consummated. But today, the Supreme Court said that states have the same broad power to challenge mergers. In doing so, the court made state attorneys general much more powerful players in the field of antitrust. The California case will now go back to a lower court, where the state will try to prove that the lucky Alpha Beta merger is anti-competitive. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
NASA engineers got the Hubble Space Telescope working again today after freeing a jammed antenna. They say the $1.5 billion instrument should be ready to begin normal startup work by tomorrow evening. The telescope's high-gain antennas are designed to transmit scientific information at very high speeds, as much as the equivalent of a 30-volume encyclopedia in 42 minutes. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. When writer Deidre Baer finished her biography of Samuel Beckett, she began searching for a subject for her next book. She wanted to write about a woman who had managed to achieve a stimulating professional life while also maintaining a satisfying personal life. When the idea of Simone de Beauvoir came up, Baer says it was like a light bulb flashed above her head. Beauvoir was one of the most free-spirited and unconventional women of her time. Her groundbreaking book, The Second Sex, played a major role in creating the current feminist movement. Beauvoir wrote many other essays and novels while carrying on a lifelong relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre. Beauvoir agreed to meet with Baer, and they conducted regular interviews during the last 6 years of Beauvoir's life until her death in 1986. The biography has now been published, and Deidre Baer spoke with Terry Gross about what had drawn her to Simone de Beauvoir in the first place.
This was the woman who, according to popular belief and according to her own four volumes of memoirs, this was the woman who had had the perfect relationship and who had also had significant influence on the way women think about themselves throughout most of the world. So I thought this would be someone really worth writing about. And that's what I believed in the beginning. I believed that she had had the perfect relationship and the perfect life.
And when you, by the time you completed the book, did you still believe she had the perfect relationship
and
the
no.
perfect life?
No, I didn't think that. I thought that along the way she had made many bad choices, and particularly in her relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre, who was her companion for more than 50 years. I questioned her choices. I spoke to her about this. As you know, I spent the greater part of the last 6 years of her life in conversation with her about her life and work. And she, though, believed that she had always made the right choices. She defended them until she died. She believed in the sanctity of her relationship with Sartre, the holiness of it. It became an icon for her, a beacon, whatever one wants to call it, the fixed point in her world. And for her, she truly believed that she had had a happy life and a happy relationship.
Well, she met Sartre when they were both students.
Yes.
They became lovers, but they rejected the idea of marriage. Why didn't she want to get married?
Because he didn't want to get married.
And you think she would have gotten married if he wanted to get married?
I think so. She always took her lead from him, and he was the one who came up with the idea of contingent relationship, that they would be important to each other. They would sign a pact, a two-year pact, and each would be the important person in this pact for the other throughout those 2 years. And if at the end of 2 years they decided that they wanted to renew it, they would for varying degrees of time. After a while, after about 4 or 5 years, they stopped renewing the pact, except perhaps with a ceremonial glass of wine to say, well, you know, we'll keep on, shall we? And of course they did.
What did the pact say?
The pact was a verbal pact. She talks about it in her memoirs. She said that one day they had gone to the movies and they were sitting in a park in Paris and they were talking, and Sartre was explaining how each would be the most important person for the other, but that if each of them wanted to experience other relationships, either physical or emotional, with other people, that each should be free to do so, and that theirs would be a pact of perfect honesty. if one of the two were to sleep with someone else, they would tell the other person and they would discuss it in detail, almost as an intellectual exercise rather than something emotional that had happened in their lives.
Sartre wanted this pact where they could have outside relationships. Well, he had quite a sexual appetite, and he had so many women that he had relationships with. How did Simone de Beauvoir cope with jealousy? I mean, their pact was based in part on an intellectual belief, but then you have to deal with your emotions, which aren't always controlled by the intellect.
Well, she claimed that she never worried too much about these other women, and my belief is that she didn't worry about them because they weren't his intellectual equals. People would say to me in Paris that people who knew them well throughout their lifetime, that she was the only woman who could follow him mentally, intellectually, that his mind was this marvel of leaping, darting, visionary thinking, and that hers was quick enough not only to follow what he had to say, but to argue, to contradict, to suggest other directions of thought, and that the two of them together made a perfect whole. Colette Audry, an old friend of Simone de Beauvoir, said that sometimes when you saw them together and you saw the intensity of what they had with each other, it made you very sad that you yourself didn't have this. So with these other women, they were sexual playthings. They were amusing diversions. They were not Sartre's intellectual equal. Sartre said many times that he really enjoyed the company of women because one could be oneself with them, whereas when he was in the company of men, they all expected him to conduct intelligent conversations or to discuss philosophy or to speak about political situations in the world. And he said, and with men, there's always a kind of macho competition. With women, he could relax and he could be himself. And so Simone de Beauvoir gradually came to believe that these diversions, these playthings and toys, were good for him, and she went along with it. In a number of instances, she actually tried to persuade young women that they should allow themselves to become Sartre's sexual companions.
There's something very sexist sounding about her attitude.
It certainly is. It's a masculine attitude, really. It's certainly a non-feminist attitude from someone who wrote The Second Sex, that, you know, that women are playthings or toys to be given to this man as he desired them. But again, that's almost too simple and too easy. You know, my book is 700 pages, and on every single page from 1929, when Beauvoir met Sartre, there is some discussion or attempt at explanation of the complexity of their relationship. To put it onto a simple relationship of sexual playthings, for example, with the women really isn't quite fair. There's much more to be said.
After around 8 or 10 years, Beauvoir's relationship with Sartre ceased being sexual, but they remained very close. And throughout her life, she followed him in a way, followed him on his travels, followed him in part intellectually. Does it contradict her views as a feminist? Does it contradict her views as someone who believed in equality in a relationship to have placed Sartre's intellect and needs in a way above her own?
I do. I think so, yes. And I did talk to her about that many different times. Sometimes it would make her so angry that she'd say, this interview is over, you know, you're leaving, and I don't know when and if we'll ever talk again, but of course we always did continue to talk. At other times, she'd pound her fist angrily on the table and she'd say, listen, this is my life. I wrote The Second Sex. I made my feminist statement, and I'm living my life the way I want to live it. I can't help it if feminist women don't like the choices I made. I made the choices that are right for me. And the choices that she made, of course, were always to put Sartre first. For example, he died in 1980, and from 1980 to 1986, she spent most of her time trying to put his manuscripts in order, doing nothing with her own papers, her own writings, anything that related to Sartre's long and varied career that she could assist with, she did. She did that even at the same time as many, many women were coming to her and asking her if they might write about her work in various ways, either as intellectual histories or feminist tracts or whatever. She'd say, no, it's not important. I'm working on Sartre today. Can't see you. And she wouldn't. In terms of how she lived her life, she claimed, and evidence bears out, the fact that she really was not very political. She didn't really believe in politics. She didn't have a credo of her own. She really followed him when he'd say, we have to support such and such a cause. We have to take part in such and such a demonstration. We have to go to such and such a country to support the revolutionaries there. She did it. Her letters time and again say, well, I don't really want to do this, but Sartre wants me to, so I have to do it.
My guest Deirdre Beer is the author of a new biography of Simone de Beauvoir, and her previous biography was about Samuel Beckett. Beauvoir had a 17-year relationship with the Chicago-based writer Nelson Algren, and among other things, he wrote The Man with the Golden Arm. She described him as the only true passionate love of my life.
Yes.
How did her passion for him compare to her passion for Sartre?
Well, by the time she met Algren, she had almost fixed in her mind the idea of herself and Sartre as the permanent couple, what I call in the book the myth of the professional couple. She had carved out a niche for herself in Parisian society, and it's very important to keep that always in mind. I try to focus on life in Paris almost as much as I focus on the life of Simone de Beauvoir in Paris, because she had evolved from a very rigid and closed society in which she was brought up to become one of the most notorious women in France. So it's important to understand the rigidity from which she came to the freedom with which her relationship with Sartre allowed her. And then you see her as his companion. As she said, for many, many years, she didn't realize that she was discriminated against because she was a privileged woman who, because she was Sartre's companion, was admitted everywhere and accepted everywhere. So that finally, the idea of them as a couple, the myth of the professional couple, became so strong. And the pleasure of her life in Paris, the pleasure of being able to go into any intellectual circle and to be accepted and indeed respected by the time she met Algren, which was 1948-1949, she had a very, very rich and full and good life in Paris. She came to the United States to tour colleges and universities for the French government, and she was their representative to give these lectures. She went to Chicago, perfectly ordinary lecture, and met this man and was, and in her words, bowled over the moon by him. The interesting thing for me is they became lovers immediately, the first night they met, actually. He took her to see the underside of Chicago, which he liked, which he needed. It was necessary for him, for the way he wrote, for his vision. He took her to see criminals and pimps and dance halls and druggies and all sorts of things that absolutely fascinated her. She always had a taste for the underside of life. Throughout the relationship, if you read the correspondence between Algren and Beauvoir, you see that it was not only a relationship of passion, but it was also a relationship of intellectual equals. Well, then, the next logical question is, why didn't she stay with this man who gave her all of the intellectual companionship and equality that she got with Sartre, but who also gave her a glorious physical relationship, a glorious emotional relationship, someone who wanted to marry her, be with her permanently, have children with her. Her reasoning was, and this is, I think, a very sound reasoning, that she was a French writer, and she could only write about French subjects in the French language. Were she to move to Chicago, she would be removed from the necessary materials that she needed to continue her creative existence. On the other hand, if he were to go to Paris, the same thing would happen to him. So it became a kind of a stalemate. They tried to work it out, and gradually it dissipated. They just weren't able to conduct a long-distance relationship.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Deirdre Beer, and she's just completed a biography of Simone de Beauvoir. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Deirdre Baer is my guest, and she just completed a biography of Simone de Beauvoir. She had said that it was thinking about her relationships with Sartre and with Nelson Algren that made her want to write about women in heterosexual relationships. When she wrote The Second Sex, did Sartre and Algren support her ideas in the book?
Algren didn't. He made jokes about it. He said, she wrote this wonderful book and that's fine, but when she's here with me in the bedroom, I am the boss, or words to that effect. He wrote some funny letters to some of his friends. Sartre didn't matter one way or the other, because by this time Sartre was so involved in his own work that he was delighted for her success. This is the interesting thing about Sartre, that he really was not a jealous person. He was absolutely thrilled for her success. But her success left him free to go on and do what he wanted to do.
Well, how did she deal with Nelson Algren thinking that, you know, to say this in a book is one thing, but when we're alone together, I'm the man?
The man
is the dominating factor.
She behaved that way when she was with him. She called herself his frog wife, and she called him her local youth or her crocodile. And she took on all the feminine, what we think of as the usual feminine attributes and characteristics when she was with him. She'd talk about, here I am trying to cook, I who know nothing, or here I am making a bed, or doing all of these sorts of things for him.
Do you see that as a lack of ability to follow and to practice what you've put into theory, or do you think that people just are what they are?
I see it as the complexity of human relationships. I mean, you know, just because she wrote a feminist book, does that mean that her life has to be a feminist polemic? People are complicated individuals, and we do things in relationships, in the privacy of our relationships, that we might not want to be known in terms of our public persona. And that's it with her. She said, you know, look, I'm living my life. I write these books, and they're important to me, but I'm living my life. I have to say that I really respect her for having defined on her terms what she wanted life to be, and for having the strength of will, and it really was will, to live that life. May not have been the life I would have chosen or you would have chosen, but it was her life.
The most important relationship of the latter years of her life was with a woman named Sylvie Le Bon, who was 30 years younger than Beauvoir was. Had Le Bon been her student?
No, not really. Le Bon was a philosophy student in Paris, and she met Beauvoir. She was very, very influenced by Beauvoir's philosophical essays as well as The Second Sex. And she, like many young women, presented herself before Simone de Beauvoir and said, you know, you're my idol, my model. I'd like to be your friend. And the friendship gradually blossomed until they became companions.
You said that there were many lesbians and feminists who assumed that this was a gay relationship between Beauvoir and Le Bon. And many women pressured Beauvoir to come out and make a public statement.
Yes.
About being a lesbian. What was Beauvoir's reaction to that?
I think that it goes back to this childhood, this rigidly repressed childhood that she had. All her life, she made denigrating remarks about homosexuals, lesbians and male homosexuals. She decried homosexuality. She made bitter, vicious jokes about it. Friends of hers, homosexual friends of hers, she treated them terribly in her correspondence when she was describing them. I talked to her at great length about homosexuality, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote the chapter on her relationship with Sylvie the way I did. Beauvoir believed that a woman could kiss another woman on the lips, could fondle another woman's breasts, could hug, could be embraced by a woman. But for her, sex involved genital penetration. And she insisted that she was not a lesbian because she had never had genital involvement with a woman. It came down to that very, very fine point. I didn't say that in the book. I thought it was self-evident from the way I wrote that chapter. But I must say that again and again, people are asking me to describe this relationship more explicitly. And so I'm simply saying what Simone de Beauvoir told me. This may not satisfy either lesbians or heterosexuals, but it's what the woman believed. I can only report what she believed.
So in other words, they did have a relationship that involved kissing.
Yes, they had a physical relationship. They frequently shared the same bed when they traveled. They asked for a double bed in a hotel room. But Beauvoir insisted they were not lesbians. As a matter of fact, the last afternoon that I was with her before she died, we were having this pleasant conversation, and suddenly she turned to me and she said, "You're going to say in this book that Sylvie and I are lesbians." And it caught me by surprise because it came out of nowhere. And she said several feminist women in Paris had told her that I was going to flat out call them lesbians. And I said, "No, I'm not going to do this because your relationship with Sylvie, as you have defined it, is not a lesbian relationship. I'm going to discuss your intimacy with this woman, but I'm not going to flat out call you a lesbian because you don't believe that you are one." And she said, "Yes, I think that's the appropriate way to say it." And so that's the way I wrote it.
Did she resent the pressure that was put on her to make a public statement about her sexuality?
Yes, of course. She resented very much the interest in her personal life and in her relationships. She wanted people to focus on the work. And I must tell you, I wrote this 700-page biography. I describe in the preface how I was on a panel at Harvard with one of Sartre's biographers. At the end of the program, every question asked about Sartre concerned his work. Every question asked about Simone de Beauvoir concerned her sex life. And I find pretty much that this is what really interests people in this book that I wrote. It's the question of her relationships much, much more than the question of her work.
And I feel like I need to address that since I've prepared an interview that really is about her relationships.
Yes.
And I have a reason for that, and that's as someone who read The Second Sex at a kind of pivotal point in my development, I really want to know how a woman who came up with such an original way of thinking about women and about women's relationships with men, how she lived her own life, especially how she lived it at a time, you know, before she didn't have The Second Sex to look to help understand male-female relationships or to help understand why woman has been perceived as the other. She had nobody to articulate that for her. So what kind of life did she live? I'm just so curious about that.
By the questions that you've defined, she lived a non-feminist life. She lived a totally non-feminist life in the shadow of Jean-Paul Sartre.
See, that's what I find fascinating.
Yes, it is. It is. It's absolutely astonishing. And the other thing is that I find now that a number of feminists are attacking me for having written the book showing the reality of her life. It's, in other words, I call it killing the messenger. You kill the messenger who brings you the bad news, which I find astonishing. You know, I'm presenting the way the woman lived her life. I'm not superimposing a thesis or a theory on it. I'm just showing how it was. And I'm sorry that people are disappointed. I was disappointed. But nevertheless, it was the life, and I had to write it the way she lived it.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us about Beauvoir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Deirdre Beer's biography of Simone de Beauvoir has just been published by Summit Books, and her biography of Samuel Beckett has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, as the African National Congress meets with the South African government for the first time, we'll be joined by South African journalist Alistair Sparks. He's the Johannesburg correspondent for The Washington Post. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. You can usually tell when Laura Dean's dance company is performing at a theater. Watch the crowd after the performance. Every now and then you'll see someone spin around trying to match the dizzying, twirling movements they just saw on stage. Laura Dean's company performs those movements this week in New York. Coming up, we meet Laura Dean. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the music we're hearing now. It's from the best of Tio Macero, one of the early practitioners of third-stream music. And television critic David Bianculli takes another look at TV's most talked-about show, Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Syria has handed American educator Frank Reed over to the U.S. ambassador in Damascus. Reed was freed earlier today in Beirut and turned over to Syrian troops who drove him to Damascus. In a Syrian television interview, Reed said no one ever told him why he was taken. He said probably the bottom line was because he was an American. As Reed was released, former hostage Robert Polhill met President Bush at the White House, NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The meeting between Polhill and the president was originally intended to be a private one with no media coverage. After word came of Reed's release, the White House announced plans for the president and Polhill to talk to reporters. Mr. Polhill, in a weak voice, said he knows what Reed is going through.
Frank Reed is going to feel the way I felt, because the American people are behind us and have been behind our families throughout this ordeal. And we're deeply grateful to you for that.
President Bush thanked Syria and Iran for their roles in the release of both hostages, but said no gestures of goodwill could be made until all hostages are freed. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
The State Department says terrorism declined sharply last year, although 16 U.S. citizens were killed and 19 wounded in attacks. In 1988, 192 Americans were killed and 40 wounded. Syria and Iran, which won praise from President Bush on today's release of hostage Frank Reed, were criticized in the annual report to Congress. The two countries remain on the department's list of supporters of terrorism. A congressional task force report on the slayings of the six Jesuit priests in El Salvador last November says the investigation is stalled and may not produce the authors of the crime. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The 19-member Democratic task force is chaired by Massachusetts Representative Joe Moakley. It was mandated by the House leadership to monitor the Salvadoran government's investigation of the Jesuit slayings. Moakley said that despite an initial good start, the investigation has come to a standstill.
This is true both with respect to any investigation of possible senior officers' involvement in the crimes and also to the gathering of further evidence against those who are already arrested.
The report says the crime, while committed by individuals, also indicts the Salvadoran Armed Forces as an institution. The report comes as Congress is moving towards making significant cuts in U.S. military aid to El Salvador. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Supreme Court let stand a ruling that says the public has no constitutional right to know the names of jurors while they're serving on a criminal trial. Prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 11.71 points to close at 2656.76. Declines led advances by six issues. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In the late 1950s, musicologist Günther Schuller coined the adjective third stream to describe music that drew on the worlds of jazz improvisation and classical composition without quite belonging to one school or another. One of the composers who'd been working this way was tenor saxophonist Tio Macero. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new Macero reissue.
In the 1950s and early 60s, the controversy over third stream music got pretty heated. At the time, the stuff sounded weird and more than a little pretentious. But listening to Tio Macero's early 50s third stream music now, it's on a reissue from the Stash label called The Best of Tio Macero. I'm surprised by how well it's held up. It has a certain quirky charm, even at its most excessive. Composer Tio Macero was born in 1925 in upstate New York. His first inspiration was jazz, but he was classically trained at Juilliard, so it was only natural that he began mixing his two interests. He wasn't alone. Among the others looking at the jazz-classical interface was bassist Charles Mingus, who employed Macero for a time in the early 50s and who's heard on a few tracks of the Macero reissue. In the early 50s, jazz musicians were still working through the implications of the new music of the 1940s, bebop, with its displaced rhythms and expanded harmonies. Not surprisingly, open-eared musicians noticed a kinship between modern jazz and the complex music then coming out of the classical tradition. Macero took art music devices like counterpoint, atonality, and tone rows, and blended them with improvising and the sonorities of cool jazz. Macero's bold twist was to use the accordion, an instrument that has made fewer inroads into jazz and European art music than any axe except the bagpipes. The squeezebox ace here is Orlando DiGirolamo, also known as Lanny DJ, who plays some pretty hip stuff for a 50s accordion player. One thing I really like about Macero's music is that he tried just about anything. In the early 1970s, he worked with Miles Davis on a series of albums that were aggressively edited from many hours of tape. Albums like Bitches Brew, Jack Johnson, and Live Evil. In the early 50s, he was already splicing together audio collages with bizarre results. Granted, not all of this music works, but that's okay. After all, jazz and classical music aren't fragile traditions. They've survived a lot of indignities and outlasted every doomsayer ready to declare them dead. There's a tendency to look at the third stream music of the 50s and 60s as the dead end. Still, more and more these days, American composers like Anthony Braxton and Muhal Richard Abrams, and Europeans like Martin Altena and Franz Kogelman, are blending improvisation and intricate structures in new ways. You may not hear the term third stream anymore, but the idea behind it is still very much around.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the best of Tio Macero on the Stash label. This is Fresh Air. Spinning, jumping, and stamping are ordinary activities that most of us took for granted as a child, but they're the movements that propel the work of choreographer Laura Dean. Since the early 1970s, Dean has incorporated these movements in her work, first as a solo performer, and then for her company, the Laura Dean Dancers and Musicians. In 1985, Jennifer Dunning of the New York Times described Dean's dances as a rich, abstruse weave of rhythms and patterns. Looked at from above, the dances unfold in starkly discernible geometric shapes. Seen from the front, they render musical impulse in design that has led some observers to think of Persian rugs. Some of Dean's early dances were set to the music of Steve Reich, but now she composes most of her own scores. Dean's company is performing a retrospective of her work at the Joyce Theater in New York. Dean told Terry Gross that the inspiration for her dances is simple.
Children spin all the time.
I remember I used to.
Oh, I certainly did too.
I love the feeling of getting dizzy.
Yeah, I mean, that's why children do it. It's a natural high. And I see children do it all the time. I happen to live across from a grammar school. And I'm real lucky because I get to see the kids spin in the schoolyard all the time. And the other day, even just on a side street here in New York, there was a little girl spinning. And she would get dizzy. Instead of falling down and laughing, because the cement is hard, she would jump up and down in place. When she got too dizzy, she'd jump up and down in place and start laughing.
How did you start spinning in the context of dance?
Well, I left the context of dance, and I think that that's how it started all over again. I left New York City in 19... I'm a born and bred New Yorker, so I had to leave New York to find myself. And I went to the city of San Francisco, and I wasn't sure whether I was going to be a part of the dance field or live in the country and build a log cabin and grow vegetables. There was just a lot of questioning that was going on at that time. So at that point, I wasn't thinking of myself in relation to the dance field. If anything, I was trying to wipe the slate clean of any past training that I had had. So one of the worst things to do in a dance class, other than walk out, is to sit down. So that's what I did. And then out of that, I got up and I started walking around the room. I got bored with sitting and said, okay, now I've done that. So I just started pacing the room. I didn't think, okay, now I'm going to go back to walking and go back to basics. I was just pacing the room, and then I started walking in circles. And that's how spinning started, very much like a child. And those early dances were things like walking in circles, jumping up and down for an hour. These are things that children do. They're very childlike.
I remember years ago, I saw the Whirling Dervishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this will be boring, just watching people twirl around. It'll be great for them, but what am I going to, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be spinning. What am I going to see? And it was absolutely mesmerizing.
It's like watching waves on the beach.
Well, did you
it's
think
It's for
of
some
a...
people, and for other people, watching waves on the beach is a big bore.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Well, was spinning a form of meditation for you, too?
Not at all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all. It was very much a natural high.
Mm-hmm.
It was... because there is a kinesthetic change that happens in your body when you're doing it.
How do you and your dancers prevent being overcome by dizziness?
Rehearsal.
Uh-huh. Is there a technique that you have for the spinning so
yeah,
that you can control
is.
That?
Yeah, there is. I've done a lot of spinning workshops, and people who have had inner ear problems and have had trouble traveling in planes because of inner ear damage or disease have thanked me for the workshops because... I do. I start off by teaching turning with using a spot, which is your thumbs, so that your eye has something to grab onto. Because us sighted people keep our balance by constantly using our eyesight. Blind people use their weight and their physicality. But we're always using our eyesight. And what happens is in spinning is that you can't use your eyesight for your balance. That's the physiological change that happens.
So you look at your thumbs?
To start with. And then you take that away, and people see the room going around, and they realize that they're not going to fall over. Of course, you know, for those workshops, people are going very slowly. You know, but we rehearse for months, and we're going very, very fast.
When you first had your breakthrough and we just started spinning and jumping and stamping, who was the first person that you showed this to?
When I came back from San Francisco to New York, I did a concert at a friend's loft to a number of friends. And the first concert that I did was on a 2x3 rug. It was a very small area because I was thinking about space as a time factor. In other words, if you have a smaller space, doesn't necessarily mean that you do something slower in it or faster. It's that whole space-time continuum, time being the rhythmic factor and space being the choreographic factor.
Have you traveled a lot to other countries either to observe dancing there or to perform there?
We've been to Indonesia, India, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, of course, all over Europe. We've not been to South America. I really think the South Americans would like what we do, especially with all the rhythm in it, so maybe someday. We've been to Japan, and it's been real interesting to see the responses from each country is very, very different.
Can you give an example of how the response differs from one culture to another?
Mm-hmm. In India, the big question was because their art form is mainly a soloist art form, especially with dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Their main question to me was, why do you have, at that time it was six dancers, why do you have six dancers on the stage all wearing the same thing and all doing the same movement? And my response to that was, so you can see the differences. And they understood that. They were fine with that. My big question in Indonesia was, this was before the Indonesians saw what I was doing. Their question from me was, if you don't give your dancers a character and a story to tell, why bother putting them on the stage? And I said... something that only the Indonesians, that I wouldn't necessarily say in the West, but the Indonesians understood, was God gives them a character. And that's what I want to, the audience to see. And they were perfectly happy with that. They understood that. That was okay. In Japan, I had a wonderful thing happen in Japan. We have a big following in Japan, and a lot of their art form has asymmetry in it. And I asked one of our Japanese fans, I said, why is it that you love my work so much? There's so much symmetry in it. And they said, one of the reasons that we create art with asymmetry in it is because we love the symmetry so much. It's to point out the symmetry. So I've had some wonderful feedback.
You had an accident as a child. You were, when you were 18 months old, hit by a milk truck. I guess I'm really surprised that you became such a physical person after having been so injured when you were very, very young.
Well, I think it's just the opposite. I think if someone has, you know, they say that adversity is the best teacher. I had to learn how to rewalk. And that isn't, I don't remember that. But I think that happens with a lot of people, in that their limitations can turn out to be their blessing in disguise. You know, you hear these wonderful stories about many dancers who were stricken with polio or were taken to a dance class because of an injury or because they were weak as children. So that adversity, you know, turns out to be a really wonderful thing, I think, for many people.
I guess you healed well. Did the accident leave any permanent
damaging
effects in your body?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, thank God I was 18 months old. The bones are still very soft then. The doctor said if I was just a couple of months older, I'd be crippled for the rest of my life. If I had been 2 years, 2 years and something, the bones would have hardened and I would have been in a lot of trouble. The only thing that I have is very funny. I have a very loud click in one hip. So, of course, I'm not a performer anymore, so I don't have to worry about it too much. But it'd be very funny in class, because you could hear it. It was quite audible.
Its own kind, it's its own kind of pattern.
It doesn't
music.
Hurt. You know, it's just something that's there. I'm very lucky. So, yeah.
Does anyone, after they see your dance, think, oh, well, that looks like fun. I think I'll try spinning.
We've had some funny incidences that have happened of people who have gone into the lobby during intermission and said, oh, what they're doing is a piece of cake. It's nothing. And tried spinning and have fallen flat on their faces. There's been a couple of times that that's happened.
So you don't recommend it, huh?
I don't recommend it.
Okay. Well, Laura Dean, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
The Laura Dean dancers and musicians will perform at the Joyce Theater in New York through May 6th. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. How are you?
Any word on the hostages?
Yes, we'll have a report on today's one hostage release. It will also, because this is an anniversary of the fall of Saigon some 15 years ago, or as in Vietnam, many would see it as the victory of Hanoi, we'll be replaying a report that Alex Chadwick of our staff made when he returned to Vietnam a couple of years ago, 20 years after his service in Saigon with the U.S. Army there. Also, news today of new methods to try to keep illegal immigrants out of the U.S. along the Mexican border.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli says he's been having the time of his life indulging in the new TV show, Twin Peaks, and the ratings indicate he's not alone.
According to ABC Research, there are three different kinds of people watching Twin Peaks. There are the ones who love David Lynch movies and come to the show expecting funny and bizarre stuff, and the soap opera fans who are interested in what happens to the characters next, and finally, there are the mystery fans who are trying to figure out who killed Laura Palmer. That may explain why Twin Peaks is doing so well in the ratings. Each episode has something for everybody. There's only a little weirdness in each show, but it's way up there on the weird scale. The casket scene, the French bread scene, and the now-famous dream sequence. And the Laura Palmer murder case is turning out to be the hottest TV crime since Who Shot J.R., only it's a lot harder to solve. A lot of times, the show works on several different levels at once. Here's Kyle MacLachlan as FBI agent Dale Cooper at a breakfast meeting with the local sheriff and his assistant.
Harry, Lucy, it is an absolutely beautiful morning. Short stack of griddle cakes, melted butter, maple syrup, lightly heated, slice of ham. Nothing beats the taste sensation when maple syrup collides with ham.
Griddle cake, slice of ham.
Who killed Laura Palmer? Harry, let me tell you about the dream I had last night.
No, let me tell you. It's one of the strangest things I've ever seen on television. Or heard on television, because parts of the dialogue sound like the people in the dream are talking backwards. At the end of the dream, a midget introduces Dale Cooper to the midget's cousin, who's a dead ringer for Laura Palmer. On TV, the dialogue was subtitled. For radio, I'll give you the translation in advance. The midget says, "But doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer?" And the girl says, "I feel like I know her, but sometimes my arms bend back." Listen closely.
"But doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer?"
"But it is Laura Palmer. Are you Laura Palmer?"
"I feel like I know her. But sometimes my arms bend back."
What does that mean? I don't know yet. But in last week's show, the same actress who played Laura Palmer showed up as another character, a cousin named Madeline. And on the TV soap opera that the Twin Peaks characters have started to watch on their TVs, there's another actress playing two roles. Listen closely again.
"Invitation to Love, starring Martin Padley as Chet, Selena Swift as Emerald and Jane."
Coincidence or clue? Could a look-alike relative be the key to how Laura could seem so good and so bad at the same time? I think it'd be just like David Lynch to bury an important clue in a TV show inside a TV show. Besides, Twin Peaks already has a one-armed man like The Fugitive. Why not look-alike cousins like The Patty Duke Show? But don't take my word for it, because I could be wrong. Sometimes I feel like I know what's going on.
"What? Sometimes my arms bend back."
That's our David Bianculli. He's also television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Artie Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alistair Sparks on the troubled history of his country, South Africa. And we talk with the newest cast member of Saturday Night Live, Mike Myers. That and more next time on Fresh Air.